just a few announcements. I had sent out the actual CDC guidelines, which everybody should have gotten in an email. But the key element in all of this, I think, is this matter of quarantining when it's not necessary. And people are stupid about this. This is unbelievable. That it's very basically spelled out. There's no need to quarantine if you've been vaccinated and have no symptoms. This is pretty straightforward stuff. This isn't hard. And if you do get symptoms, let's say one of us gets sick. Now, obviously, we should probably be careful. But if somebody thinks they're having an allergy attack and it turns out to be COVID, how are you going to know? And if everybody's going to start skipping class at the least little sign of I'm sneezing or my finger hurts, you know. So the key elements to check, of course, are the big symptoms, a cough, headache, a fever, and if you start getting any loss of sensation, smell or taste, big tips. But, you know, obviously we don't want people skipping Bible classes because they got allergies. That's not contagious for one thing. And the real reality is even if everybody was exposed, which I don't think any of us actually were, because I don't think any of us were within 5 feet or 6 feet of this person for 15 or 20 minutes on end. It just didn't happen. So, again, I sent out the CDC guidelines and realistically, after you test positive, 10 days later, you're good to go. I mean, unless you're just getting noticeably more ill or you can see. But if you're getting better, you're on the mend. And one of the things I read here about this matter of testing, and of course, they've sort of indiscriminately promoted testing. Just get tested all the time. Well, no, you really shouldn't. Number one, first, if you don't know, there's an inherent potential for a problem anytime they shove something into your skull. This can go bad in a number of ways, but they can introduce an infection. You know, they likely won't, but it could happen. So as I was reading, this comes from the doctors at BayCare Health and the Florida Department of Health in Hillsborough County, which of course just reflects the state mandates generally. And it says, nearly 15 months into the pandemic, is it possible to get tested too much? And the answer is yes. He urged people from the Florida Department of Health not to get tested repeatedly once they have tested positive. So, I mean, I know our fear is, or the thinking seems to me, the natural thinking is, well, if I've tested positive, I've got to know, how will I know I'm free until I test negative? 10 days later, you're free. That's how you know. You can count to 10, you've got it covered. And I think all of us here can do that. So I want to make it very clear, he said. They should not be retested. It is not required. It gives bad information. It can keep people out of work or isolated up to 6 weeks, 3 months, or more, and has no value. And the chief medical officer at BayCare said you can evaluate each situation independently, which that makes good sense. I mean, obviously, if you are in a higher risk group, you have known comorbidities, well then yes, that makes a little more sense to be more cautious. And that to me is just basic common sense. But he said he cautioned against people who tested negative getting repeatedly retested. And people are doing this. And it, number one, it overwhelms the system. This is part of the problem with lab work. Why you can't get quicker answers is because people are getting tested that don't need to be tested. And in many cases, and then how's this going to play out if Biden's mandate goes into effect? And millions, tens of millions of people are going to be tested weekly? Oh my, this is going to be problematic. So he said the more we test people who don't need to be tested, the harder we make it for people who actually need results. So both CDC and BayCare and the Florida Department of Health all said, even if you're symptomatic, stop isolating after 10 days from the onset of symptoms. But again, you can read your body. You have some sense if you're getting better. I mean, if you're, feel like you're 1 foot out of the grave, maybe stay at home. But you haven't had fever. It says 24 hours. I would have thought they would have said 48 or 72, but they said no fever for 24 hours. You're good to go after the 10 days if you've been exposed. So he said after no fever for 24 hours, if they've been well for 3 consecutive days or without fever for 24 hours, they are considered to be recovered. And so that's all we can do about that. I think God's more than capable of protecting us and has been. And I have not panicked over this as much as some people have. After I got over the initial fear of the government using this as a power grab, which clearly they are. But what can we do about it as believers? We can sit around and bemoan the conspiracy and wring our hands. But what are you going to do about it? And the answer is you just got to keep living your Christian life and let God take care of it. And so the fact is, vaccination makes a huge difference in all of this. And they've made this repeatedly plain. The people are holding off on vaccines. 90% plus of those are the ones headed to the hospital. And you say, well, you could be 1 out of 10 who got vaccinated. I'll take my chances. 1 out of 10 is a lot better odds to not get it than 9 out of 10 is. And so I can do basic math, too. I'm not that smart. As Winnie the Pooh would say, I am a bear of very little brain. But I can do math. And the math tells me I'll take my 1 out of 10 chance every day over 9 out of 10. And so some of this is basic common sense, but again, the fact is people panic. They don't stop and think. They get under fear, and they believe that this is going to kill us all. And guess what? Managed to stay safe through it so far. And I don't think we've complied with what they've asked. We did that 2 weeks. 2 weeks to slow the curve. Guess what? Didn't slow it a bit. All we did was waste 2 weeks. But okay, so we did it. When we assembled, we only assembled on Sunday for quite some time, so that if there was any kind of outbreak or somebody showed symptoms, the odds of you being infected were far less because you wouldn't see them during the week. And the fact is, there's been no evidence. A couple of people here have had COVID, both survived it and doing just fine. And so I think it makes a huge difference, as I said in my deal, just written on the front of the book in large, friendly letters, don't panic. And people have a tendency towards that. And not that I never have. Like I said, I wouldn't have handled Paul's test there in the jail too well, probably. I'd have been questioning God and all that. But the fact is, we see Christians and leaders like Paul and the way they lived and the way they acted in the face of stuff that's even worse than what we're dealing with. Because we have technology to help us overcome all this stuff. But the fact is, God has protected us, and I'm still fairly certain that He intends to. He hasn't let me know, hey, it's time to, I'm taking the lampstand, you're done. And I would presume I would be one who would get the information at some point. So anyway, we hang in there, continue to do the right things, pray for other people, other local churches like Greg's who are still trying to do the right thing and assemble. But other people, I've said this many times, the internet's going to be the death of the local church, just like it's going to be the death of the brick and mortar store. And we've watched this happen. Brick and mortar stores have drying up. The ones that aren't drying up have consolidated, like Staples and Office Depot. They're all one thing now. And you see these places all sitting empty. And the fact is, failure to assemble, failure to have a local church, then where are you going to go on the internet to get your stuff? There's not going to be a place. So the local church, to me, is still the backbone of Christianity. It has to be. And so we're going to constantly promote that, assembly, face-to-face teaching, encouraging one another. And very difficult to encourage somebody when you never see them. Encourage people with their prayer requests and all that. And I won't go off on it today, but we're going to have to figure out how, when we send out a group text, to reply to the sender only. Because my phone was blowing up this morning. Well, I was happy Rena and Bill were well. After I got the initial text, I kind of knew. And I'm glad, we're all well, but when you look at your text, now if you don't know how to use your phone, we're going to do that. We'll devote to iPhone smarts or whatever you got. No, we won't do that, but there is a way to respond just to the sender. So figure that out when you see you've got a group text. So my phone isn't blowing up all morning. And it was going off so many times. Linda said, I don't know what's going on here, but this phone's been going off. And I hadn't even quite got up yet. So,
But at any rate, we're very grateful for the positive volition that God has assembled here. The local church here has survived now going on, well, now it's actually 32 years. And we've continued to do the things we are doing, teaching verse by verse, systematically, getting the truth before people, trying to get people convinced that where the rubber meets the road is where these applications are going to have to be made. So now let's go on here then with our, and we are grateful, by the way, too, for those people who can't get to Bible class and listen online. Those who can get to Bible class and listen online, no, we're not grateful for those. I'm not. I'm not grateful for that at all. I think that's a complete violation of what you're supposed to be doing as a Christian. So, and there's always rationales and reasons and justifications for it all. But they very often only satisfy the one who offers them. They don't very often satisfy me. Or most of us that can think. If you can think and recognize God's going to take care of you. And again, those large friendly words, don't panic. So Roman numeral 9 now here, we're ready to keep moving on here. Occasion, and normally I would have titled this occasion and purpose, but here, occasion and purposes. Because having done some of these books, in some reasons, like for Ephesians, that there were no known problems in the church. He wasn't really addressing anything specifically. And it was very difficult to discern an actual reason for writing other than what you find within the book itself. The contents kind of reveal to you what the issues are as Paul sees them. So when one considers the matter of why Paul wrote to the Philippians, it is natural to believe that there may have been a primary motive in writing. And however, just because one has a primary motive, that doesn't rule out a secondary, tertiary, or other motives Paul may have had in mind when he composed the letter. And really, the only way to fully know would be to interview Paul, and since we can't get to him right now, he's otherwise indisposed, we're just going to have to try to work it out. And some way, the way you work this out is, you know, and it does have some benefit to reading some of the church fathers and their views on what was going on, although that's somewhat limited. But the content of the book will very often help us to figure out, well, why all is he writing to them? So most interpreters have acknowledged that one key reason Paul writes, now this has been mostly the orthodox view for centuries again, is to acknowledge the receipt of the monetary offering the Philippian church had sent to him by the hand of Epaphroditus. And some have argued against this, saying that's not at all why he writes. He's not writing at all to thank them, which that's nonsense because there's clearly thanksgiving in the letter about this specific subject. So clearly, that's one of his purposes, at least. So they've argued against this by suggesting that Paul does not bring up their gift immediately. So since he doesn't do this, it's not really his reason in writing. Well, I think there's good reasons not to do that. Number one, it's crass. To make money the issue right out of your letter, right? Dear Philippians, grace and peace to you. Thanks for all the fish. That doesn't really square. I think the way he puts this off, not that he's never going to allude to that, because obviously they knew why they'd sent Epaphroditus. Everybody was clear on that. But he does bring it up at the end of the book and thanks them very much for their sacrifice and their offering to him. Well, however, the fact that Paul waits until the end of the letter to mention it makes good sense for some reason. The first is that Paul generally does not make money an issue because money is not really the issue for the adjusted minister. You have to, and we have had to. We're not in any financial difficulties in this local church because we've always been very frugal. What offerings came in over and above, we've put aside. We still have met living grace needs when they come up. We've met other needs that have arisen and all of that. But the fact is, we've been very frugal and we view this. I know I can speak for Bill. I've never had anybody. I would never have anybody on the board that didn't recognize this is God's money, not ours. And this is the sacrifices of believers. This is not to be treated lightly. This is to be handled with the utmost of care. And as Paul demonstrated that same sort of mentality about the Jerusalem offering. We do not want to be indicted for handling this badly. We want to keep everything open and above board. That's why we do an annual audit every year, get somebody from the congregation. We like to get somebody different every year, just to mix it up so other people can make that application. We're not going to force you to do it, but we still have applications that have to be made. Well, again, money's not an issue for the adjusted communicator. What we have done is normally all you can do really when you're financially planning is to some extent look to your past and history and see what historically has gone on and then make your plans for the future somewhat based on that. And what we have done is changed the allocation, my allocation, depending upon what the finances were, so that the way we've kind of calculated it out, it would be 4 years or so, something like that. 4 years or so before we would run out of money. And the way we do this is we look at what we bring in, say, in August. We look at that in the meeting in September. And then we look at what that was minus our expenses and all that. And then we adjust the allocation for me up or down based on what the finances are. So while we were in the four, we were paying me flat an allocation of $6,000 a month. Well, now that allocation sometimes is four, sometimes it's been $4,500, sometimes five. I think the highest it's been now would be $5,500. But, and if it goes back and we only do $3,500 one month, so be it. It's just the way it goes. And you have to be willing. I mean, if you're not committed to this and money's going to get you out of the ministry, well, then you shouldn't have been in it in the first place. And our boast is that we will take care of the finances and we will make the adjustments, and what sacrifices have to be made have to be made. And years back, the attitude that I inculcated or tried to into the board and into the congregation is the attitude of whatever it takes. It's whatever it takes to get the job done under God's will. If that means suffering and sacrifice, so be it. If it means blessing, so be it. We're willing to take from the hand of God what he delivers. And so you have to be. And I think Paul certainly was. Paul never made money an issue. And rightly so. Well, the second is that their gift was sacrificial to some degree, which likely resulted in some suffering on their part, which Paul praises as an appropriate sacrifice that God will honor. That's in the chapter 4 there, as he's getting down in his final thoughts to this matter of the gift, finally. And that's not to say, again, that he doesn't allude to it in the early part of Philippians. But it's not the primary focal point, that's for certain. Where are we at here? 4, 18, and 19. But I have received everything in full, and I have an abundance. I am amply supplied, having received from Epaphroditus what you have sent, a fragrant aroma, an acceptable sacrifice that was well-pleasing to God. And so we, when we talk about it, the sacrifice of grace giving, we observe it weekly. Not that we would never do it more if we had need to, but once a week we can take up the offering. You know it's always on Sunday. And so if you don't show up on Sunday, we're pretty sure you're not giving. That way we can know. But the fact is, the reality is, it just streamlines things. I don't see any reason to take an offering every time we have a Bible class. And also, too, the administrative part of it, Bill's got to take care of all this, get everything in the books, make sure it's done right, get it to the bank, and all of that. And so why complicate all that any more than we need to? But, you know, what we'll do, I think, in the future, we've talked about it, and that is, if he doesn't like what he's seeing, it's going to go around again. No, I'm kidding. We would not do that. Okay, I don't like this. Or he'll stand there and shake it in front of you if you're the offender, and that way, you know, everybody will know. All right, the third thing is here that by waiting until the end of the letter, now, Paul's gratitude for their application is the final thing they hear from him. He leaves his gratitude and thanksgiving ringing in their ears. And that makes good sense to me. That's how you'd want to close that. Because he was grateful. So F, it is clear from reading the letter that while the monetary gift was one of the purposes in writing, there are other purposes in writing which include the following. One, he wanted to send Epaphroditus back to the congregation in Philippi. since they were aware of his brush with death. This letter formed the perfect opportunity to send him back to that church. And that had to be at least part of his motivation. Because he says it is. He spells that out. And additionally, Paul was aware of the fact that Epaphroditus was homesick and experienced significant anxiety over the Philippians' concern for him. That's Philippians chapter 2. And some people handle, you know, things like this better than others. This matter of being homesick is something that people experience. Because he was longing for you all. So I wanted to send him back. And he was distressed that you had heard he was sick. And so this matter of his illness put pressure on both him, because he felt bad that these people were worried about him. And it put pressure on Paul, who worried about Epaphroditus and also about how the Philippians were taking all of this. And it's intriguing, of course, that here's Paul in prison, and what's he more worried about? Other people than himself. And his primary issue, that's one of the things he's going to make plain, is the defense and confirmation of the gospel. His personal circumstances take a big backseat to that. And always do and always will. So it is clear, again, there are other writings. So he wanted to send Epaphroditus back. Two, additionally, Paul was aware of the fact that Epaphroditus was homesick and experiencing anxiety. So not only, point three, would the Philippians be informed of his status, they would certainly rejoice when they were reunited with their beloved brother. And additionally, Paul's own concerns would be mitigated. That whole section there, those five verses from 25, about why he thought it was necessary. And he speaks of Epaphroditus. Now, he could have just said, your brother Epaphroditus, or our brother. But he speaks of him in glowing terms. My brother and fellow worker and fellow soldier, who is also your messenger and minister to my need. He heaps these bits of praise on him for his Christian life and what he's doing. And he says, but indeed he was sick. He was longing to get back to you. He was sick to the point of death. So this was very serious. I mean, if we would say today, he was in the ICU for a while, probably. And they wondered if he's going to make it. They didn't probably have an ICU, but the fact is. It was probably nice that Luke was there. Being a physician and all, that was probably good. He had mercy on him, and not on him only, but also on me. So that I would not have sorrow upon sorrow. I mean, can you imagine how you would feel if these people sacrifice, take up this offering, send it to you, and the guy they send dies in the fulfillment of his mission? That wouldn't leave a good taste in your mouth, I wouldn't think. I understand how Paul would feel there. Therefore, I have sent him all the more eagerly, so that when you see him again, you may rejoice. And I may be less concerned about you. See, this takes a little of the stuff off of Paul's plate. We all have a lot on our plates that we deal with. And sometimes not having to be concerned about something as simple as someone's health just relieves a little of that anxiety, a little of that pressure. And so, as he says, receive him then in the Lord with all joy. And hold men like him in high regard, because he came close to death for the work of Christ. Risking his life to complete what was deficient in your service to me. So they would certainly rejoice. Obviously, this alleviates concern on Epaphroditus' part, on Paul's part, on the Philippians' part. And so to say that that was not part of his motivation, I think, is to miss how concerned and involved in all of this Paul was. So for another obvious reason for writing is that the Philippians were very concerned about Paul, since they knew he had been imprisoned and was awaiting trial. Thus, Paul has a desire to provide firsthand information regarding his circumstances and his prospects for the future. Philippians 2, back up in that chapter there, 12 and 13. That's probably supposed to be 1. Yes, that's 1. Change that. I have trouble knowing, you know, where stuff's at in the Bible, which is, makes my job a lot harder. Chapter 1, sorry about that. Now, I want you to know, brothers, that my circumstances have turned out for the greater progress of the gospel.
Now, that would be encouraging for the Philippians to hear. And once again, it tells you that Paul didn't look at things merely as how it affected him. This is a part of occupation with Christ that we're going to see in this letter. If you're occupied with Christ, you're more concerned about Christ and others than you are about yourself. But for some believers, all they see is how it affects them. And that's the sign of a self-centered believer under their sin nature. That this is, oh, look at how it affects me. You're not the only person here in this. We all are together. We should be concerned for one another more than we are ourselves. And that is going to form one of the critical components of his work in chapter 2. Do not merely look out for your own self, but also for the needs of others. So I want you to know that this turned out so that my imprisonment in the cause of Christ has become well known throughout the whole Praetorian Guard and to everyone else. And again, as I've told you, the word guard's really not there. It's an interpretive translation from the New American Standard. The Praetorian was literally the house or palace there. But obviously he's referring to those people. Well known means there's people in it. So I understand why they did that. But there was more than just the guard in the Praetorian. So as with other letters, Paul also addresses the matter of opponents that believers and local churches face in the angelic conflict. Now that comes up in chapter 3. And the fact that he does this so abruptly has caused, again, interpreters to say, well, Paul didn't write this. Doesn't seem like he would do this. But there's no evidence that he didn't. Philippians 2 and 3, we'll start in verse 1. Finally, my brothers, rejoice in the Lord. To write the same things again is no trouble to me. And it is a safeguard for you. So there's a certain amount of built-in repetition within Paul's teaching. And he acknowledges, he doesn't apologize for it. He said, I want to keep these things before you. So chapter 2 here, or verse 2, beware of the dogs. If anybody's windows are down, you may want to run. beware of the evil workers. Beware of the false circumcision. For we are the true circumcision who worship in the Spirit of God. And that's what Jesus told them in John chapter 4 back there. The worship of God must take place in the realm of the Spirit and then in the realm of truth. And he says this is where we worship. And we glory in Jesus Christ and put no confidence in the flesh. Well, there are people who are just convinced that they are confident in themselves and that they know how to handle anything. And that their way is always right. It must be nice to be so smart. But no. No confidence in the flesh. By the way, there's an Old Testament verse, cursed is the man who trusts in the arm of flesh. So if you're looking for people for deliverance, you better get your eyes back on God. Again, this matter of occupation with Christ and how it manifests itself. There, and he insults the opponents. Now, this is something that does strike me. He doesn't necessarily clearly identify him, but he insults them. I mean, dogs is an insult. Beware of the dogs. That's an insult. And he instructs the Philippians to emulate his attitude and example. One of the ways you can tell over the course of time is that if you're constantly at odds with your communicator, then you're at odds with God at a certain level. You just have to be, assuming the communicator's doing the job right, and Paul was. And so if they're at odds with Paul, they're at odds with God, whether they want to admit it or not. And so let us, as he says, therefore, as many as are perfect, i.e. mature or complete, have this attitude. So you're supposed to have the same attitude that Paul has. And we should manifest this attitude. And if anything, you have a different attitude, God will reveal that also to you. I haven't gotten to this verse, but I suspect he's saying God's going to reveal to you that you're wrong. Is kind of what I think he's saying, but I haven't got there yet. And also, verse 17, brothers, join in following my example and observe those who walk, i.e. who live their lives according to the pattern that you have in us, the apostolic team. And so the fact is, if a person is going to do God's will, you have to follow in line at a certain point. But of course, that goes very much against the Babylonian mentality. I'm a rugged individualist who only goes my own way. And I can't listen to anybody else. I know I'm smarter than all of them. And that mentality will get you destroyed in the angelic conflict. It does not help. So follow my example. And observe those. Keep your eye on those who walk according to the pattern you have in us. And again, follow them. And keep your eyes open for those who don't want to follow the leadership. Even though everybody, when they joined this local church, said part of their agreement was we will obey the leadership, believing that they have been ordained by God. Oh, until I disagree with them. Well, I guess we forgot to put that caveat in there. But that's not what you agreed to. You agreed to follow the leadership. And it would be different if we were teaching false doctrine, getting the field, flat earth, all kinds of crap we could teach. Superimposing stuff over the scriptures. Not getting on in the text. I mean, at a certain point, if you're in a book, and some of you can testify to this, some pastors are going to live and die in the book of Genesis. They never get out of it. And there must be some sand traps or something in there that I missed. Because I remember I did the book of Genesis and I got through it in about, it seems like it was 4.5 years or something. And it's like 50 chapters. So, and it's mostly narrative. I mean, not that there aren't didactic things in there you have to stop and evaluate, but mostly it's narrative. So people are going to live and die in that book, I guess, but we managed to somehow survive it. So again, he wants them to insult. He insults the opponents and then says, follow my example. So 6, as seen in Ephesians and other letters. Paul was always concerned about the matter of unity within the local church, which he addresses in three places. Philippians 1:27 in the first chapter. Only conduct yourselves. This is the first thing he's concerned with. I think he uses monos here. Yeah. Only or alone, or this is my first or single concern, my greatest concern, we might say. That you conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ. So that whether I come and see you, or whether I remain absent, I will hear of you that you are standing firm in one spirit, with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel. And the sad fact is, unless your pastor's a spiritual numbskull, he has some sense of whether you're loyal to the truth or not. Pastors do have discernment, some of them anyway. Have discernment. I've seen some that I wondered if they had any, but that's a whole different lesson. We won't teach that today. But here, the key element, one spirit, one mind. We're supposed to be striving for the same things. When somebody's consistently at odds with their leadership, it manifests spiritual maladjustment. Or a big failure on the part of the pastor. But then I'd have to have everybody here completely snowed. And are you going to get up and say, well, he's got me completely snowed. I can't see at all what he's doing. I'm completely fooled by it. So 6, as seen in Ephesus and other letters, he's concerned about this. He also addresses it in chapter 2, 1 through 4. Therefore, if there is any encouragement in Christ, if there's any consolation of love, any fellowship of the Spirit, if any affection and compassion, make my joy complete by being of the same mind, maintaining the same love, united in spirit, intent on one purpose, and do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves. Do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but also for the interests of others. And then chapter 4, at the conclusion of the letter, he brings it up again. Actually, we can get into verse 1 here. My beloved brothers, whom I long to see, my joy and my crown, in this way stand firm in the Lord, my beloved. I urge Euodia, and I urge Syntyche to live in harmony in the Lord. So they had these two women in their church, apparently notable women, who were obviously at odds and would not get their situation reconciled. And it was creating conflict for other people. This is one of the things you observe in certain believers. Wherever they go, there's conflict. They're always in it with somebody.
And this manifests a huge spiritual problem and is a big tip-off. Indeed, a true companion. I ask, and I don't know, I'm assuming he's talking to the pastor of this church here. But again, I haven't gotten this far in the book. But I asked you to help these women who have shared my struggle in the cause of the gospel, together with Clement also, and the rest of my fellow workers whose names are in the book of life. And so he wants unity. He doesn't want these people at odds with one another. But you have to unify around the truth. And when people are arguing about what the truth is, there's no unity. And to me, the truth isn't all that difficult. It isn't that difficult to figure it out from studying it. Again, he was always concerned about the matter of unity. And the simplest motivation of all is that Paul had a deep Christian love for the Philippians because of their positive volition towards the truth. He missed them and wanted to continue to share his ministry with them. And that's, again, kind of sprinkled throughout the letter, beginning in chapter 1, 3 through 5. I thank God for my entire memory of you. All my remembrance is what he's got. But anytime he thinks of the Philippians, he's blessed. He's not, he doesn't immediately think of the Philippians and go, oh, the Philippians. Now, he probably did that with the Corinthians. Oh, the Corinthians. They kept him up at night, I'm sure. 3 through 5, they're always offering prayer with joy. In my every prayer for you all, in view of your participation in the gospel, from the first day until now. Also 2:17 and 18. So Paul loves these people, and this might be in the... he talks about his ministry, and even if he's being poured out as a drink offering, I rejoice and share my joy, he says, with you all. But you, I urge you, rejoice in the same way and share your joy with me. 4:1, we've seen that one, and then also 4:14 through 16. Nevertheless, as he says, you have done well to share with me in my afflictions. And so Paul loves them, and he's grateful for this. There's a lot of gratitude in this letter. And you yourselves know, O Philippians, that at the first preaching of the gospel after I left Macedonia, no church shared with me in the matter of giving and receiving, but you alone. For even in Thessalonica, you sent a gift more than once for my needs. And while I fully believe the adjusted communicator is not in this for the money, most of them don't say no to it either. So, is a monetary gift appreciated? Sure, but they're not necessary. Again, the local church here has taken sufficient care of me over the last, probably 15 years. Before that, it was a little dicey. But I had some very wealthy people, but I didn't make very much, But I never begrudge people what they get or what God gives them. I pray for you to be blessed. Pray that same prayer all the time that's in 1 John or 2 John, I think. I pray that you will prosper and be in good health even as your soul prospers. But you got to have soul prosperity first. Many believers want to put the cart before the horse. Money will show that God's for me. No, it doesn't. There are very many wealthy, evil people out there. And if you think God's for them, you've kind of missed the point. So all these things likely contributed to Paul's motivation. The primary theme for the entire epistle is found at the beginning of the prologue, where it is introduced and summarized. And he will continue to expound on this throughout the letter in various ways. But the key element here in verse 5 is, and they translated here, participation. But really, it's our Greek word fellowship. It's koinonia. It's sharing things in common with Paul. And this is the partnership, the fellowship that they had that was established very early on that both parties saw the need for. And to say Paul established it with them or they established it with him, I think kind of misses the point. I think it's mutual. And in that regard, it was probably not planned. It was probably spontaneous. That there are times I remember when I first got with the truth, and I was really excited, and got on doctrine. You want to participate, or at least I did. I wanted to be involved. And so I was eager to apply. And not that I'm not now, but one of the things you're warned about is these evil days that are going to come on you when you can't apply as much because you're not as mobile, you're not as young, you're not as vibrant as you used to be. So there. Well, somebody killed my computer. All right. So, all right, you'll be flogged at the end of this class. So, just kidding. So there, and then verse 6, in view of your participation, and I am confident that he who began a good work among you all will perfect it until the day of Christ. He's very confident of their further participation and unity with him. That they've given him nothing, no reason to question their loyalty in all of this. So the first obvious thing that stands out is Paul's memory of his entire history with the Philippians, for which Paul offered thanksgiving. There in 3 and 4 we saw that. However, in all his fond memories of them, one particular feature is highlighted in verse 5, which Paul will continue to develop, which focused on the Philippians' partnership in the gospel. And 3, when verse 6 is interpreted properly in relation to verse 5, these four verses provide the main theme of the letter. And the rest of the letter is concerned primarily with their development as partners in the gospel. So the Philippians will be blessed with a fruitful phase too. This is the one thing in life we have. This is the coin of the realm. Time. You got 24 hours a day. That's it. You're not going to get any more. And once that day is gone, it's gone. You can't fix it. You can't change it. You can't redo it. If the opportunity to apply presents itself, you better seize it. Now, this is truly carpe diem, seizing the day to apply, to figure out what God wants. And we have to be discerning about that. That's another thing that's going to come up in this. While Paul wants believers to apply towards one another, he wants them to apply in the realm of full knowledge. He doesn't want them to be stupid about it or uninformed. And he wants them to apply in a discerning way. That we're not just willy-nilly throwing things at people. Because you look on the TV, I mean, all you got to do is watch the news for 30 minutes, and you'll see more needs than we could possibly ever even meet. And are many of them legitimate? All of them probably aren't, but are many of them legitimate? And so we have to be discerning in what we're going to support and apply and all of that. And we've tried to. We just don't spend money indiscriminately. We think about it, we pray about it, and then we go from there. So they want to have a fruitful phase too, and the eternal rewards that come to those who partner in the gospel. And essentially, for this to work out, that's what it is. And people understand business partnerships. Two people come together because they got a common idea and they want a common goal. And that's what any partnership is. And each one of them brings something to the agreement, to the partnership, or you wouldn't need them. And so in the same way, every believer brings something to the table. In terms of what they can contribute, what they can apply. And it starts in small ways, but then you apply and you contribute. And you strengthen the local body, working together with other believers. Or you can just be a law to yourself and assume that this is going to work out for you. But I'll tell you right now, it's not. I've seen people over the years that were spiritual laws to themselves and they're all out of Bible class now. I can't think of one of them that's still in class. And the list is long. Very long. So the outline of this, quickly here, the salutations found in 1, 1 and 2, the prologue including his thanksgiving and prayer, 3 through 11, his biographical prologue, which links Paul's circumstances with the prologue, and then moves into the body of the letter. It's a bit of a transition there between 12 through 26. He talks about, of course, the first and foremost thing is the importance of the gospel and how that is impacted by all that's going on. And then he talks about his own personal circumstances and what all is going there and how that impacts what's going on. And then he closes there, of course, at the end of the chapter with this one thing I want you to do here. And that is to conduct yourselves in a worthy way. So that's where he really starts kind of what we might call the body of the letter is in verse 26. This is the first exhortation he offers them. So the body of Philippians is 1:27 through 4:9. One, exhortations to a worthy walk are found in 1:27 through 2:18. And that will include, of course, the greatest example of all, God the Son, Christ Jesus, who sets our example. And I think about it, you know, sometimes I find myself praying, you know, dear God, help me to be the pastor I need to be. Help me to be the husband I need to be, the friend I need to be. And really, all of that can be summed up in help me be like Jesus. He's the standard. He's the example. And this is the way we are to try to live our lives, of putting his standard, his example first. What would Jesus, literally, what would Jesus do? But even before that, take your bracelet off. But even before that, it's what would Jesus think? And then it's what would Jesus say? And then it's what would Jesus do? We have to be aware of all of that. But that's where we are working on this, is conforming our thinking to the Bible. That's we got dirty brains, we got to wash them. And that's what the washing of the water of the Word will do. It cleanses you, it tears down. But we got to get to some of those faulty things first. In any renovation, you've got to have demolition before you have rebuilding. And we have to get to the human viewpoint, the nonsense, the demonic doctrine some believers have accepted, the way demons influence their lives, and they are oblivious to it, apparently, which is sad. I even had one believer, demons don't do anything in my life. Well, then obviously you're no threat. I'm not sure I would say that out loud. The demons don't bother me. Yes, because they know I'm a zero. I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't make that boast. Well, the exhortations here to a worthy walk, the commendation of both Timothy and Epaphroditus, that takes 18 through 30. Warnings about opposition and the exhortation to emulate Paul. This is what we have to get up and say as communicators. While we're not perfect, while we fail, we fall short. Generally speaking, if you're in Bible class, every time I'm in Bible class and you're paying attention and you're learning, you're going to do fine. So there's an exhortation to emulate the example that you see. What is actually important in life? Where are our priorities? Then the concluding exhortations are found in 4:1 through 9. The epilogue, the closing of the letter, Philippians 4:10 through 20. And that largely is occupied there with that matter. That's where he starts to deal with it. With this great financial gift they sent him. And this is what allowed Paul, by the way, to keep his own rented quarters. Gifts like this that came to him. He couldn't go out and work. And so this allowed him to continue the ministry in Rome, even under house arrest, where he couldn't go out and do things. He was chained to a guard all the time. But he continued to, he didn't have to go stay in the prison. Well, that's got to be a big bonus. If you know anything about most prisons, they're not fun places at all. And the Roman prison, Mamertine, certainly wasn't. So the epilogue there is in 10 through 20. And then the final closing salutation to greet the people and the benediction he offers at the end of his letter is 21 through 23. Okay, I did get out the next set of notes through. You should have up through chapter 20. Yes, that's a long book. Page 20, sorry, will be out. I think I've sent them. I might not have, but if I didn't, I'll check it when I get home. And we will pick up here on Tuesday. Have your notes for chapter 1. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship in the things of your plan. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our souls so that we continue to grow, a partner with you in everything we're supposed to do, and ultimately reap the great rewards of glory which come to those who diligently seek you. For we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.